Did you choose the red or the blue pill for your life? Or was it the black pill? David Sacks chose the red pill and is in the process of red pilling the wider tech community. Not only does a picture of David show up in the dictionary when you look for the term based, his gray hair looks suspiciously similar to that of a silverback gorilla. David Sacks might be the most underrated Silicon Valley personality, and that's about to change in the coming years, as we will find out, because David is starting to play by the playbook on how to gain influence and power, and he's disregarding haters and certain media in the process.
Because the good news is, it's kind of like Reggie Jackson said, they don't boo nobodies.
But more on that later. A lot of us who don't know where to go in our careers can learn so much from David. Yet so few resources cover his story and do his polymath CV justice. Studying economics in Stanford, then law in Chicago, from McKinsey to co-building PayPal, being one of the top operators in the Valley, producing award-winning movies, building one of the most iconic VC firms focused on SaaS, and managing to produce 3 children in parallel to all of that.
At home, I got family to do.
Oh, family? Have you met him? What were they like? Are they everything you expected?
I had to meet the new kid.
He's 19.
What's his major?
Today, we are going to explore the Giga Bateman that is David Sacks, his rise to money and power, and what we can learn from it, and why he might soon become the Silicon Valley titan you hear about most. They seem to put something in the drinking water in South Africa. Both Elon Musk and David Sacks were born in South Africa. And while Elon is more impressive on a net worth scale, David Sacks might actually offer more learnings to benchmark from. Like Elon, David Sacks, at a young age of 5, performed a quick Monte Carlo simulation on the economic prospects of South Africa. He concluded that he'd be better off pursuing the American dream in the US. Thus, similar to Elon, he moved his family to the US at age 5. Fast forward 17 years, numerous college parties, and just generally being an absolute Chad, and Sacks obtained his BA in economics in Stanford at age 22.
I graduated college in 1994, and law school was the default path for smart people or people who are just good at school who didn't know what else to do with their lives.
Thus, 4 years later, at age 26, Sacks obtained his Juris Doctor from Chicago Law School. For diehard Sacks fans considering studying law now, today, he probably wouldn't.
Would I do it today? I mean, I think it's so much easier now to, if you want to do technology, there's so many more resources. It's become more tracked, actually. You know, there's these programs like Y Combinator, where it's like a 4-week course where you'll go there with your idea and they'll help you incubate it, things like that. So today, I think it'd be a tougher question.
Law school had another consequential advantage for David. It was also where he met his brethren, Peter Thiel, 2 alpha brethren with a unique set of abilities united to pursue their megalomaniacal dreams in the greatest country on planet Earth. But first, David fell into the classical prestige trap that we already discussed in my video, The Career Path for Ambitious People and Why It's a Trap. He joined McKinsey because it was a cool thing to do back then, which it is not anymore, according to Sacks. Something else has taken that place.
Being a founder is like the new McKinsey.
Sacks stayed at McKinsey for not even a year, a time frame that does not really allow for any deep learnings. It typically takes a couple of months to get acquainted with the culture of an organization, build strong relationships with the partners at the firm, and convince them to staff you on the engagements of your choice. But it was enough to give him a prestigious stamp on his CV. Now, it was time for him to take his first unconventional step. Maybe because he knew that he would never build the next big thing at a place like McKinsey.
It's not necessarily the McKinsey consultants or the Harvard MBAs who figure out these new markets.
Or because the opportunity he was presented with was just too attractive to be ignored. Because what would come next would change his life forever. And this is where it gets interesting for all of us watching, trying to become the next Giga Bateman.
David version of this was to get rich is glorious. He has created billions of dollars of value for our world, and we're here to hear how you can become him.
See, Sax was not your average ambitious student. He figured out very quickly that the traditional legacy business world is not for him.
No matter how big the pot of gold was at the end, even if I knew for sure that I was one, after 20 years, was going to be the highest whatever, I still wouldn't do it.
He didn't want to be stuck in a linear salary progression. And even though he might not say that publicly, a young alpha like David certainly aimed for goals he would never have reached in consulting or banking.
There's not like a track. You know exactly where you're going to be in your career in 10 years and probably know what the salary is going to be and all this sort of stuff.
In other words, he had that drive, that Bateman gene, and he would put it to good use. Around that time, brethren Peter Thiel and Max Levchin had just started a small payment startup called PayPal. David Sachs, massaging Excel tables at McKinsey, had thought he missed this whole internet thing.
And, you know, I actually thought I had missed the whole internet thing.
Peter approached David, and David was in, mainly because PayPal was aiming to go big or go home. They even had an index that our channel 100% approves of.
We sort of knew on a, like a certain level that it was changing the world. Like at PayPal, we had this user counter that would track the user growth. We called it the World Domination Index.
At PayPal, David Sachs took the role of the COO. In the present, he's often referred to as one of the greatest operators of all times.
There are two individuals who are considered the greatest operators of all time. One would be Sheryl Sandberg, and of course there's David Sachs.
What the f*** is an operator? Well, you have the CEO strategizing and promising stuff, and you have the COO trying to fix the shit in the background. What exactly did Sachs do that was so wonderful? Well, one thing was that under his leadership, PayPal grew revenue from zero to $240 million per year. The company introduced business accounts and expanded into multiple currencies and over 80 countries. Nevertheless, at one point, PayPal was losing money so fast that there was a real danger that they would go bankrupt.
I think our company was burning about $10 million a month.
But we know how the story ends. PayPal had their initial public offering in February 2002. There was massive tension and nervousness as it was one of the first IPOs after the September 11 attacks. On the first day of trading, the stock rose more than 54%. And a couple of months later, in October 2002, eBay acquired PayPal for $1.5 billion. Jackpot. David Sachs whetted his beak for the very first time. He didn't make hundreds of millions or billions, but it definitely qualified as fuck you money. At this point, let's run a little thought experiment. What if Sachs would have held on to his stake in PayPal?
PayPal is at a 300 plus billion market cap today.
Probably sold these companies too early. I think one of the dilemmas about being a pioneer in a market is you don't really know how big that market's going to be.
Sachs could be much richer than he is today, up there in multi-billion dollar territories. But the truth is, it's very difficult to assess the right time to exit a startup, especially if you are not rich yet, and thus you are tempted by the money that's being offered to you. Do you really want to risk falling back to zero? That's why typically it's necessary for a founder to have one to two smaller exits that provide for some fuck you money. A couple of millions in the bank, and during your next startup, you will be able to hold out longer before giving in to these billion-dollar acquisition proposals. And also for Sachs, PayPal would not be his most successful exit. He still had much bigger things in the pipeline. But first, he went into the movie business.
I'd always liked movies, and I watched a lot of them, especially third year of law school.
The most popular movie Sachs produced and financed is the movie Thank You for Smoking. The movie follows the efforts of Big Tobacco's chief spokesman Nick Naylor, who lobbies on behalf of cigarettes while also trying to remain a role model for his 12-year-old son. And of course, David was successful with it. What did you expect? Thank You for Smoking was nominated for 2 Golden Globes in 2007. The movie also won Best Screenplay at the Independent Spirit Awards, Audience Awards at both the Munich Nordic and Norwegian film festivals, as well as some more awards that probably none of my audience has ever heard of. The movie was produced on a budget of $10 million and grossed $39 million in box office. Although David wet his beak, it's safe to say that he worked on movies because he was intrinsically motivated and passionate about it. Nevertheless, after some years, Sax was looking for a new adventure.
Well, after spending a few years in Hollywood, I started to become nostalgic for the relative sanity of Silicon Valley.
His next adventure would prove to be far more profitable for Sax than PayPal, a smart move that would elevate him into the hall of Silicon Valley founder and operator legends forever. In 2006, Sax founded Genie.com, a genealogy website that enables family members to collaboratively build an online family tree. What happened next is a beautiful example of how solutions that solve a startup's problems internally can sometimes be spun out as a separate company. Sax wanted more visibility into what was going on across the organization at Genie. His team created a productivity tool to help employees share information. In 2008, Sax and co-founder Adam Pisoni spun this internal communications tool into a standalone company called Yammer. Yammer is a bit like a company internal Facebook. Employees can communicate, post status updates, or collaborate in working groups. Thanks to a secret technique, Yammer was one of the fastest growing software as a service companies in history, exceeding 8 million enterprise users in just 4 years, and pocketing an impressive $142 million in funding from venture capital firms. How did Yammer achieve this rapid growth? What was the secret?
And I tend to focus on bottom-up SaaS. It's SaaS, it's business software where the users or the employees of the company pull the software into the company like a consumer would. So it's kind of consumerized business software. That was the go-to-market strategy or the idea that Yammer really pioneered, you know, a dozen years ago. We were a bunch of consumer internet guys after PayPal, I had done consumer, who decided to attack business software. And we didn't really know anything about it. But in those days, business software was distributed via a sales team, and it was done through the IT department. And our idea was that we can make it viral and kind of go over the heads of the IT department. This eventually became known as shadow IT, and we sort of pioneered this concept.
Just 4 years after founding Yammer, David Sax had an exit event that was much larger than his PayPal exit. Sax's ownership of Yammer was significantly higher than his PayPal ownership that was diluted through various stakeholders. So when Microsoft acquired Yammer as a core part of its cloud social strategy, he didn't just have f*** you money. He was now what we call liquid. The acquisition price? $1.2 billion.
Well, at the end of the day, I think you got to be a little bit crazy to turn down a billion-dollar acquisition offer for a company that's like 3 years old.
With so much money in the bank, what do you do next? You register an account at Chronify, something you can also do with a much lower net worth, by the way. Chronify, a startup that received investment by one of the besties, is an application that helps you plan and track your path to high net worth. It's essentially the app to my YouTube channel. For example, we talk about having a 10-year master plan often. Chronify helps you track just that, your overall financial health on the way to achieving your goals, taking into account your participating career, side ventures, one-off liquidity events, and so on. The truth is, if you are not aware of your current net worth and the inflow and outflows, you are doing not enough. How are you going to optimize your expenses? How are you going to plan big, risky investments in the future? Most importantly, I found that being aware of all my various income streams motivates the hell out of me to grow them even further. Tracking everything via Google Sheets in the past was a pain in the butt, which is why I was genuinely happy to come across Chronify. Through the link in the description below, you can sign up for a free trial without any obligations and start plotting your plan for becoming liquid. Something David Sax certainly is at this point. And he's also a big fan and friend of Peter Thiel. As we discussed in my Peter Thiel documentary, Thiel had a unique strategy after his liquidity event. Thiel applied a three-pillar strategy to both conserve his wealth and maximize the probability for moonshots. Firstly, he started a hedge fund to preserve and grow his capital. Secondly, he became active in venture capital, doing angel investments and starting VC funds. Thirdly, he became a venture builder, founding Palantir. Sachs took a more focused approach, essentially focusing on Pillar 2, venture capital. His experience as an operator gave him a unique edge to choose and support the most promising startup investments as an angel investor. And what a track record he had as an angel. Zenefits, House, Palantir, Facebook, and Uber were all on the list of investments he did. After a short and successful stint as an interim CEO at Zenefits, a company he had invested in 2014, Sachs was ready to take his investing career to the next level. Staying true to his operator and SaaS expertise, he launched Craft Ventures in late 2017, an early-stage VC firm focused on SaaS and marketplace businesses. To call their first fundraise a success would be an understatement.
So you started a new fund. It's a $300 or $400 million fund. You raised it in 6 minutes, it seemed. How long did it take you to raise this fund, and how big is it?
We raised $350 million, and it took, I guess, probably about 3 months.
Which is ridiculous.
Since then, he has gone on to raise more and larger funds. A $500 million VC fund in 2019, a $612 million VC fund in 2021, and a $510 million growth fund that same year, sneakily taking advantage of all the liquidity in the system. But who can blame him? The truth is, unlike other VCs that are best at providing unsolicited advice to founders while enjoying soy matcha lattes, Sachs is the real deal. For example, he helps his portfolio companies implement one of his greatest strategies, the operating cadence.
The cadence, and it's about how you put your startup on an operating cadence to reduce the sense of chaos and synchronize all of the efforts of the employee so that it's not a shit show.
Will Sachs ever return to the poker table, go all in, and hope to build another massive company? It's unlikely.
I go on Zoom calls a couple of times a day. It's a great life. It's flattering, but I'm done operating.
Although Sachs fans will know that he started a social podcasting app called Call In summer 2021, around the time when people still gave a single f*** about Clubhouse. The app essentially reduces the barrier to entry for aspiring podcasters while allowing users to retain ownership of the content they create on the app. People can create rooms like on Clubhouse, but they can also record conversations, publish them as podcasts, edit the audio material, and so on. Sachs had started a show on his own app called Sachs on SaaS, but stopped uploading in January of 2022. At the time of this recording, Call In clearly hasn't taken off. Yet. All in all, it's fair to say that Sachs is now mainly an investor. Now, running a perfectly orchestrated VC fund with billions assets under management and just having to attend a couple of Zoom calls a day, what is there to do for Sachs at this point? He clearly is no big fan of spending excessive time in nature either.
I mean, Sachs is never going to go into the forest and even go near a tree.
He doesn't go outside.
I go outside sometimes. I much prefer going to an outdoor shooting range.
So what's there to do? Exactly. Increase his influence. For one, much like his friend Peter Thiel, when it comes to politics, David Sachs doesn't hide his opinions.
Free speech got digitized. That caused the town square to get privatized and the First Amendment got euthanized.
These kids go to these schools. They spend 5 years there. They get a degree in some woke nonsense. And of course, it doesn't help their earnings power. These degrees are worthless, right?
The scariest thing you can hear is, you know, I'm from the government and I'm here to help, that sort of thing.
My friends on the pod, they're all getting red-pilled to one degree or another.
He has a clear opinion about most issues, and even more refreshing, if he doesn't have one, he simply admits that.
Sachs, you've been quiet in all of this. I know that you hate the environment and regulation. What's your thoughts?
I'm just not deep in this topic, so I don't want to weigh in.
Sachs is viewed as a hardcore conservative by many spectators, but he is actually someone that cares more about the cause than about the party, which is another parallel to his friend Peter Thiel.
And so, you know, I never initially saw myself as a conservative. I saw myself as more of like a 1960s style liberal who believed in free speech.
The way David takes more influence on the political power scene is by having clear opinions on topics and being vocal about about them, donating money to politicians and causes he cares about, as well as hosting fundraiser events that were controversial to some.
I do want to ask you about the fundraiser you're hosting for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who obviously is a very divisive figure, has made some choices that are questionable when it comes to public health. I know that you don't necessarily agree with all of them, but why do you support such a divisive candidate, especially given the global health crisis we are still facing?
But other than Peter Thiel, David is also taking control of distribution. He started taking the All In podcast more seriously in Q3 and 4 of 2020, together with his besties, Jason Calacanis, Chamath Palihapitiya, and David Friedberg. Since then, he has been gaining around 10,000 to 30,000 Twitter followers monthly, much more than before. On the podcast, he and his friends talk about all things politics, business, and tech from the perspective of four tech gorillas. In the past, David Sachs has learned that distribution is incredibly important for startups, and it is obvious he is now applying these learnings to his personal brand.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, the All-In Pod was more of like a lark. I mean, it was something that, you know, I did with a few friends who I play poker with, hence the name. We did it, I think, starting in March of last year during COVID. Everyone was kind of locked in their homes, and it's like, hey, let's do this pod. We kept each other sane through COVID by doing this pod, and it somehow found an audience and people like it. And so it's encouraged us to keep going with it. There is a big benefit to it, which is that we control distribution for our own ideas, which I think is really important now.
Even more so, as David has been always aware of the danger of free speech being digitized and the First Amendment being euthanized, as he calls it. Today, it is all too easy to get canceled if you disagree with the woke mob. Not for Sachs, though.
And so I felt a little bit of an obligation to speak out more because, you know, economically, if I get canceled, I'm still going to be fine.
David is chronically critical of the media. And even though he has started appearing on more and more traditional media outlets, most importantly on Bloomberg, by positioning himself on a number of key topics, he still does not want to rely on the traditional media to get his point across. The All In podcast is a perfect medium for that, despite some hiccups in the process.
And then I speak for like 5 seconds without you interrupting me.
Why can't I monologue? Yeah, guys, go start your own fucking podcast.
David Sachs built a colorful life for himself, juggling multiple passions and, most importantly, managing to be successful at all of them. His life offers many lessons for all of us, constructing our careers and master plans for world domination in the future, and it will be worth it following him around in the future. Lastly, he has some advice for all of us who are walking on unconventional paths, where sometimes you might be tempted to take reputational risk to get to your goals.
You know, I think one of the things that is never very clear when you're in school, but I can tell you is like super important in the work world, is the power of your reputation. It's other people's perception of your quality and, you know, how good a job you do.